Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are very grateful to be here today, September 14th, 2023. Myself and my colleagues, Judge Peter Reyes and Judge Tracy Smith at the St. Louis County Courthouse. We really appreciate St. Louis County Courthouse for welcoming us and these proceedings to this courthouse. We have three matters on our oral argument calendar and one matter on our non-oral argument calendar. So we're going to proceed today at roughly 10:05 a.m. with the first matter in our calendar, and I will call the case. So it is 823-0702, Duluth Preservation Alliance Appellant versus North Creek Investors LLC. Respondents, City of Duluth respondents. We have the appellants and respondents present. And I'm just trying to pay attention to council table. It appears to me as though at the respondents table, we have at least two council. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The respondents have worked out that the City of Duluth will have 10 minutes and the respondents, North Creek and Zach, will take five.
Okay. And you, council, would you advise me? Are you?
Paige Orca.
Okay, very good. And I'm sorry, you said the city will take 10 minutes. And Marshall, are we able to make that adjustment on the clock? So you're aware of that? You don't have to do it yet. That'll be the respondent's time. But you are able to do that? Just because the other option, of course, is we can all just pay attention as the clock counts down. Is the clock visible to everyone in the courtroom? All right. So I have just a couple of quick additional remarks and then we can go ahead with the arguments. So again, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We very much look forward to hearing from you today. So these proceedings are being broadcast or made available via Zoom today. So there is a live recording or a live streaming of these proceedings. We are also doing an audio recording, and that recording will be made available on the court's website. Now, having said all of that, one of the things that I'm trying to encourage everyone to do is two things. First of all, when counsel begin your arguments, you will want to identify yourself as well as the client you represent, so our record is clear. Secondly, you'll want to pay attention to the clock so you know that your time is ticking down. We very much look forward to the conversation with you today, and we hope that we'll have that opportunity to have a little back and forth and understand the issues better in your case. So with that, we are ready to proceed. Counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready. Hopefully you can see the clock.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Miles Ringsred. I represent appellant, the Duluth Preservation Alliance in this matter. The matter before this court today involves the once contributing structure, which I will refer to as the Astoria Hotel, in the federally protected Duluth Commercial Historic District, which I will refer to as the District, and the environmental review process that the owners of the Astoria and the City of Duluth conducted pursuant to the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, MEPA, in order to demolish this protected resource. This matter is actually the second lawsuit brought by the Duluth Preservation Alliance with respect to the Astoria and subject environmental review. The first, the record reflects, was brought by the Duluth Preservation Alliance because the city had no intentions of even requiring environmental review for the owner's proposed demolition of the Astoria. After decades of failing to comply with the obligation, the city had these contributing structures in this district. It was only after this first lawsuit was brought that the city acknowledged its obligations to conduct environmental review when considering an owner's requests to impair or destroy a contributing structure in this district. However, rather than follow the standard review process established to ensure proper review and require the owners to complete an environmental assessment worksheet or an EAW, the city chose an alternative form of review and sent the owner's demolition application to the federally certified Heritage Preservation Commission.
Counsel, if I could ask a little bit of a clarifying question, and this kind of goes to what the claims are that are being challenged on appeal. You had mentioned MEPA.
Correct.
And there were four claims that were brought in the district court with respect to MEPA, right? And those four claims were against the City of Duluth. And there was one claim that was brought against the city and the owners under the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act.
Correct.
Or sometimes referred to as MIRA. It's my understanding, though, that appellants, the Duluth Preservation Alliance, is not appealing any claims with respect to MEPA, the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act. Is that correct?
Correct. The MIRA claims, there was an issue with notice, and so those claims were voluntarily dismissed.
Okay. Thank
you. So this is just for Minnesota MEPA and not MIRA.
Okay. And so, but the only claims in district court were brought against the owners were under MIRA, right? M-E-R-A.
I don't believe so. We did, and this gets partially to one of the owners' arguments, essentially that MEPA does not even apply to private owners, and it really only has to do with a city's requirements for conducting a review. And if the court would like me to go into that, I can.
But was that claim preserved in the district court, the MEPA claim against the owners? Because I thought the only claim that was brought against the owner was the MIRA claim.
I would have to review the claims again. Off the top of my head, not seeing it in front of me, I can't tell you. But my recollection is that there is a MEPA claim against the owner.
Okay. Let's assume for the sake of argument that there is one. And you had referenced the fact that owners' argument is that MEPA only applies to government agencies. Can you explain how a private entity would be covered under MEPA? Because the language in the statute seems to focus primarily on what the government does, the governmental entities. It doesn't seem to talk about actions against private entities at all.
That would be correct. Essentially, the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act is really laid out to instruct in the review process that is needed to be conducted for environmental review purposes. And so typically, the NEPA requires either an RGU, a city, or someone to conduct that review or require that review to take place. However, I'd first like to note that, and even in respondents' briefing, this isn't a matter that the district court ruled on. And so it's not necessarily even something this court has anything to review. They didn't make a determination on this issue. So I'd want to point that out.
Right. But this court still has the authority and ability to affirm a district court on alternative grounds as well.
Correct. And so essentially where this comes into is really the conversation of an indispensable or a necessary party. I'd like to quote a case. It's no surprise that the appellate courts and at least four other states have concluded in similar circumstances that a property owner who obtained a zoning variance is both necessary and indispensable in a judicial proceeding to challenge the grant of the variance. That is Schultz v. Town of Duluth.
Right, but a necessary and indispensable party goes under joinder rather than whether or not they would be, at least in the district court, whether or not they would be a defendant in a case. So it seems like the MEPA claim is one that has been brought against government entities. I mean, can you point to any case law where a MEPA claim has been brought against a private entity?
I can't.
Okay.
And again, I would also point to some of the rules where essentially if this were an EAW process, it is the owner's application. A challenge to the review is a challenge to the owner's application and affects their interests. So much so, if you look and refer to regulation 4410.600, in that it says the RGU shall assess the project proposer, in this case the owner, for reasonable costs that the RGU incurs in preparing, reviewing, and distributing an EIS if there was an, if they followed the standard EAW EIS process. And so it is appellant's position that as an indispensable party, as a party that put forward the proposal, a decision on that, they ought to be at the table when we are discussing and considering whether they follow the proper procedure or not. It affects the interests as they're the ones who are the project proposers.
Let me ask a follow-up question. This is an issue that I will acknowledge that the owners specifically raised, the city talks about a little bit, but that's the whole mootness issue because unfortunately the building has been destroyed. And so why doesn't the mootness doctrine apply here? Because it seems to me that that's a legitimate question to raise. Does that apply? So then if it applies, then there are two exceptions. And how are those exceptions met in this case? And I realize you point to mitigation, but that mitigation is under the environmental rules here. And I think we need to look at what is the standard under the mootness doctrine itself.
Correct. As you pointed out, there are essentially two factors. Stated in Lemur v. Swanson, a matter is, quote, moot when an event occurs that makes a decision on the merits unnecessary or an award of effective relief impossible. A decision on the merits here is necessary to determine what the proper review process would be. Is a city allowed to impute in a city ordinance that doesn't have any of the same criteria that is directed under MEPA for environmental review? Does it allow them to conduct review pursuant to an ordinance that has none of that? This is an important decision that should be made so that going forward, the understanding of this review process is clear.
That sounds like you're asking us to provide an advisory opinion, though, and we don't issue advisory opinions.
Well, in this case, it's not necessarily even advisory because then that gets to the second part, or an award of effective relief is impossible. And that's where mitigation comes in. And mitigation can come in many, many forms. And part of this lawsuit was brought by the Duluth Preservation Alliance because of the decades of the city not recognizing this obligation that it had to conduct review pursuant to MEPA when it was considering the demolition of contributing structures. There is something called de-districting. Each contributing structure is protected, and the district itself is a protectable resource, and that is a combination of all of these contributing structures. If you slowly, as the city of Duluth has allow properties to be demolished, contributing structures to come down, a district can be lost. The historic district, a protectable resource, can be lost. And so mitigation can come in many, many forms. Effective for in mitigation, the EQB has many rules that discuss mitigation about avoiding impacts, minimizing impacts by limiting the degree and magnitude of a project. It could
Council, I apologize for interrupting you, but I just want to make sure that you get a chance to enlighten me, as I'm a bit confused about your mitigation argument, and that is probably all me. And so go right ahead and help me out. It seems to me that mitigation would come into play with an EAW, right? And I realize that you assert that that's the process that should have been followed here and wasn't followed here. But what do we do now about that? Can an EAW be done now that the building's been destroyed?
No, not really. So, I mean, essentially, an EAW is, as I stated, the rules allow them, because this is a protected resource and they were required to conduct environmental review, that typically you do an EAW. And the EAW sets out a lot of elements that that need to be reviewed. It's sort of a dummy-proof way to conduct environmental review, whereas there are alternative forms of review that are anticipated under this statute and these rules. And so you can get...
Not getting back to the mootness,
litigation.
Right? I mean, if you're claiming that mootness is an avenue that would provide, or I'm sorry, that mitigation is an avenue that would provide the appellants with relief, but it's not triggered without an EAW, I don't see where you present a live controversy to the court. It just seems to me that there isn't relief that can be provided.
So if the district court, if this court agrees that if this goes back to the district court, court can fashion relief and mitigate. So our issue, as I said, has to do with the destruction of contributing structures throughout the district. They could create certain restraints on what can be put in place there, design elements that can be put in there. They could require some sort of damages be put in to help preserve other aspects of this district. There are numerous ways. It is very broad in terms of what mitigation would mean in a situation like this, which would be assessed at the district court level.
But those are situations. Are any of those situations pending right now?
No, because the matter has been it was dismissed essentially on the pleadings, essentially saying because the Duluth Preservation Alliance, this gets more towards sort of the city's arguments, that because we did not appeal this decision to this court, rather we brought it to the district court, that it was the district court did not have jurisdiction to hear these issues.
So going forward, let's assume for the sake of argument that another historic site had been requested to be demolished. Couldn't the Duluth Preservation Alliance engage in these other procedures to prevent the demolition?
Again, they could attempt to, but that herein lies the problem with much of environmental litigation and in a historic context and in environmental context. Bonds, trying to get injunctions in place, it's nearly impossible. In this matter, the district court gave the Duluth Preservation Alliance 1 week to come up with $60,000 when the city and owners didn't support a bond request for that amount with anything other than just a figure. So to try to keep kicking this can down the line will just ignore the realities of the situation that would be forced upon the Duluth Preservation Alliance or anyone who is trying to protect resources within this district. And I see my time is up. So unless there's any further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. And you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you Correct. Choose to use it. Yeah, thank you. So we are ready for the respondents. Thank you. Clock is getting reset.
So may it please the court and counsel. My name is Paige Orcutt. I'm an assistant city attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the city of Duluth. The city respectfully is seeking this court to dismiss this appeal or, in the alternative, affirm the district court's ruling. I'd like to discuss two issues with you today. First, the statute of limitations issue, and second, the subject matter jurisdiction ruling of the district court. I'm going to discuss the statute of limitations issue first because I think that is a threshold issue for this court to consider. In this case, the district court found that plaintiff's NEPA claims were brought 42 days after the city council's decision. This is outside the 30-day window provided by 116D.04 subdivision 10. This matter is therefore dismissed under Rule 12.
That was counsel, subdivision 10 is a 30-day period to file a petition for certiorari in the Court of Appeals, is it not?
Correct.
What is the statute of limitations on a district court action, assuming that there would be, for example, this included a mandamus action as well as other, claims in district court? So if the district court could consider those actions, what's the statute of limitations for bringing a district court action?
The city's position is that all NEPA claims should be brought by writ of certiorari to this court.
So it's more a question of that's not here, not that they missed the deadline, they didn't bring it here. It's in the wrong court, is what your argument is.
Correct.
I don't see a statute of limitations argument raised with respect to, I don't even know what the time period is for a district court action, if there's subject matter jurisdiction over it.
Correct, Your Honor. At the district court level, what the city argued was that the appellants brought the case in the wrong court and at the wrong time. We argued both, essentially in the alternative. If the district court were to find that it had jurisdiction, the matter is still time barred because of the statute.
By subdivision 10?
By subdivision 10 of the statute.
Okay. Were there environmental review conducted here?
Yes, Your Honor.
And who was the RGU?
The City of Duluth.
Okay. The environmental review here's my question. As I read that rule, and this is just to understand sort of procedurally, you know, what happened. So rule 4410.4300 says when there will be an EAW must be prepared when certain thresholds are met. And then it says the thresholds in the following circumstances. So that's a mandatory EAW. And then we get to subpart 31. And it says, you know, for the destruction whole apart, with the exception, this does not apply when there's HPC review. So, HPC didn't order, I'm confused about how this all works because HPC didn't order an EAW. HPC's denied the application and then the City of Duluth, reversed that, right?
The City Council, yes.
City Council. So I'm just confused as to what the environmental review was and I don't think there was there's one thing to have mandatory EAWs, right? In which case you have to do it. And then otherwise there can be a petition for an EAW. And this is a question for appellant. I don't know that there was a petition for a discretionary EAW.
There was not a petition in this case.
Okay. So the question is, was there a mandatory EAW required? And I think it was the City of Duluth determination that if that's the RGU, that no, there wasn't. But it doesn't apply the standard of for an EAW that would be discretionary. Like, would there be a probability of environmental effects, blah, blah, blah. So I'm confused about it all. And you can see, RGU and who did environmental review and where did that live?
Let's walk through this together. Okay. I agree. It's a interesting issue. The statutory framework tells the EQB to create rules about when and where to do EAW, EIS, or alternative review. In this matter, we are in the EAW world, but as noted by Your Honor, this rule says there's mandatory EAWs unless a local certified historic preservation commission reviews. That's what the rule says. The rule says you don't need to go do an EAW if your HPC is reviewing the destruction of a historic property.
Right. It's non-mandatory.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. So essentially the city has proffered that's another avenue that this rule, this historic places rule, provides four different types of review. Again, under this EAW framework, four different avenues for environmental review, one of which is an HPC. The other ones noted in this rule are Section 106, other types of this, the projects reviewed under Section 4740. So there are four avenues that are outside of EAW that don't require an EAW, but they're still under the EAW framework. Within that, and that's all the rule says. Then we look to the city's ordinances, which provide for an administrative appeal process of the commission's decision, the HPC's decision, may be appealed to the city council. And the city council is then reviewing that decision. We would offer that is environmental review. It meets the standards of both the statute and the rules. And in addition, it meets these interesting obligations we have as a city under 15.99. So that's a zoning statute that says the city must provide a decision within a certain amount of time. And if the city does not, then it is granted as a matter of law. So
the environmental review that's done by the HPC and then, the city decided differently on isn't whether or not to do a discretionary EAW. That's not even what they're asked to decide.
Correct.
It's whether to approve or not the application for a certificate of appropriateness.
Correct. So the regulation is for the destruction, whole or in part, of a property that is listed. So this is not a question, as you noted, this isn't a petition, where we would be under a different framework for those, the petition type of review. Instead, this is for a certificate of appropriateness for demolition of a historic property. We've got some competing case law. I think 500 LLC and Moreno are two cases that help stitch together this framework and showcase that the path that this property was reviewed meets all the criteria for both environmental review and 15.99. Because the city's framework provides for an appeal process, if the city council would not have considered it, then under 15.99, the permit would have been granted. So it's a competing framework that we think you can read together by utilizing 15.99 and the case law that interprets 15.99 and how that applies to this very specific certificate of appropriateness, as well as MEPA and its regulatory framework.
So apropos of the mootness, I know you didn't make a mootness argument on MEPA claims, right?
Correct.
Also, maybe I won't even ask you that.
I will say we would join the mootness argument. It's just that at the district court, the city viewed that those arguments were only presented as to the MIRA claims, the MIRA claim, which is not on appeal at this time. So getting to the statute of limitations, this threshold issue, the appellant here did not appeal the district court's ruling as to the statute of limitations, and even at the district court level did not argue that the statute of limitations ran from any date other than the date of the decision of city council. It's for the first time in the reply brief to this court that the appellant makes that argument. So to the extent that argument has now been waived. That was not presented to the district court. And under Thiel v. Stitch, which is 425 Northwest 2nd, 850, an appellate court generally does not consider matters that were not presented to or considered by the district court. So the district court clearly ruled that this matter was time barred by the 30-day statute of limitations. And getting perhaps to Judge Bratfold and Judge Reyes's questions regarding mootness and what would we remand if we remanded, you'd be remanding the time barred matter because you have not been asked to review the statute of limitations. That was not an issue presented for appeal, and only in the reply brief were you presented with argument about it.
Well, the mootness issue would not be one for remand, though.
Correct. The mootness issue would be one to essentially not provide this court with any relief to give to the appellant.
So,
and I'm sorry, I meant to make a parallel there, Your Honor, about the, not only is mootness for the building itself has now been demolished, but similarly, under the statute of limitations, anything that would get remanded as to the MEPA claims, those are all time barred. And the district court did rule on that, it was not appealed. And even if this court were to take up the statute of limitations issue de novo, semi-sua sponte, that it would be time barred under the clear 116D.04 subdivision 10, which Judge Smith does incorporate statute. And if I just may finish this point.
Before anything.
It does incorporate statute 14.63, which provides from the date of the decision. So that.
To the Court of Appeals.
To the Court of Appeals. And with that, I would just ask that you respectfully either dismiss this appeal or affirm what the district court held. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Tom Thorgerson. I represent North Creek Investors and Zach NSC Asset Investors, the owners of the property on which this building previously stood. I'm here today to ask you to affirm the trial court's dismissal of the claims against my clients for two reasons. One, MEPA doesn't expose them to liability in any form. And number two, if it did, the claims would be moot. Facts, the determinative facts here, are simple. Owners are not government entities. They're private parties. The owners applied for and received all the necessary permits to demolish this building, including a certificate of appropriateness and a demolition permit. the appellants actually obtained a temporary restraining order, and they could have stopped this and had all the determinations made at the district court, but they chose not to by not paying the bond. And I will take issue with the comments of the appellant's counsel this morning on the bond issue, but that's not in the record. Bottom line is a $60,000 bond was required. Appellants did not meet that bond requirement, and the injunction went away, and my clients proceeded to demolish the building with a valid permit to do so, and proceeded. There is no building there any longer.
Counsel, before you get to the second argument of mootness, which I would like to discuss, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked appellant's counsel on whether or not what claims, if any, survive against the owners on appeal? Because I may have missed something, but I thought that appellants only are appealing the MEPA claims. Were there any claims brought against the owners at the district court that survive on appeal?
All right, I'll address that. The complaint, sort of a shotgun complaint, okay, utilize respondents without identifying which parties are which, okay? During the oral arguments, and frankly, the written arguments and oral arguments in the district court, our position going into that was that the only claim against us was the MIRA claim. But in fact, in the response, plaintiff's responsive brief, it made the argument that we were somehow exposed on MEPA claims to mitigation under MEPA. And in fact, we opposed that, and we still oppose that, because the mitigation arguments that were made at the district court and even now don't apply to MEPA liability. And even the rule that appellants refer to on the mitigation, which is rule 4410.0200. All that is a definition of mitigation under the administrative rules. And it is not used to identify available mitigation for a violation of MEPA. What it's used for is under rule 4410.1700 as one factor to determine whether environmental review is necessary to begin with. So getting back to your question, Your Honor, the complaint, it was not clear. Arguments at the district court raised issues of whether my clients had exposure to mitigation under MEPA. And the district court's order, if you read it, it says it's going to dismiss with prejudice the MEPA claims against my clients, if any, or to the degree asserted. I think the judge was just as confused as we were. So our position is, there really is not an express MEPA claim made against us, but boy, arguments were made to the degree that we're here making sure that this court knows we believe we don't have any exposure under that statute. The only exposure is to government entities taking government action. That's not us at all. So moving on to the mootness argument, there's no building, there's no relief left. We have cited cases in our brief that deal with demolition of buildings, one that actually deals with MIRA and MEPA. The other one doesn't deal with MIRA and MEPA, but the demolition resulted in mootness. Thank you. We would ask.
One second, counsel. Any other questions from the panel? Okay. Very good. Thank you, counsel. Really appreciate it. All right. We are ready for rebuttal. We'll reset the clock and you will have 5 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to just, as we kind of focused on the mootness and the owner's argument about whether there are proper parties here, I'd like to turn to some of the statements and arguments made by the city and sort of address Your Honor's questions about the process that went on. And so This is a mandatory EAW category. At least those are what the rules call it, which requires review. EAW, a mandatory EAW is sort of a misnomer here, because what it really is saying is mandatory review process. They could have taken an EAW process, which is typically what's done here, but they chose to rely on the Heritage Preservation Commission route. This is called an alternative review process. So this is really just what triggers the need for environmental review, not just an EAW.
Well, I'm wondering how your interpretation of subpart 31, I think, is just for the state law. Let's not get into the ordinances, the state rule.
Yes.
That lays out when EAWs are mandatory. I think you think it was mandatory. Is that right?
Review was mandatory, yes.
Well, that rule says an EAW must be prepared for projects that meet or exceed the threshold of subparts. And that's why I'm confused about this alternative review idea that you're having, because that rule starts with an EAW must be prepared in the following circumstances. And then we get to circumstance in subpart 31, and it's for the destruction in whole or part, blah, blah, blah. And then it says, except this does not apply to projects reviewed by a local heritage preservation commission. So I'm not sure if you think that the HPC goofed up by not doing environmental review performing an EAW, who you think the RGU was, where the problem lay exactly. I'm not sure. This rule seems to be about mandatory EAWs as a whole.
Correct. And as this says, they would have to do this except for if the Heritage Preservation Commission reviews this, which then gets them to that the ordinance. And so that essentially comes down to, at least in appellant's mind, the alternative review process. If they're not going to be doing an EAW, instead of doing an EAW, you can do an alternative review process, but that has to be either approved by the state, or it has to contain the same subject and elements that an EAW would contain. And so I'd like to quickly address the reason for the dismissal under Minnesota Statute 116D04 Subdivision 10 with respect to the statute of limitations and subject matter jurisdiction. We brought it up in our brief. I'd like to point this court to final alternative urban area-wide review case, which is pretty smack on point here, where it really comes down to the fact that we are not appealing the decision of either the HPC or the city council. We're not appealing the reasons why they came up with their decisions and all of that. We are appealing a process in which they took to make these decisions. In that the final alternative case, it was held when they were discussing this same 116D04 subdivision 10. It stated, the language is clear. The legislature only authorized certiorari review for final decisions regarding environmental impact statements or environmental assessment worksheets. Because the authorization of certiorari review does not include any reference to alternative forms of review identified or created by the board pursuant to subdivision 4A, we conclude that this court cannot exercise certiorari review. There are numerous cases cited within our brief in which specifically under environmental review in the same context, when you're not appealing the decision of an EAW or a decision made by the HPC or whatever alternative review process is, when you are appealing the failure to comply with the statute, comply with a review process, or to even conduct review, that is properly in the providence of the district court. I would ask this court to look to the plain language of the city ordinance, which only allows review of locally designated historic structures, and really just the absurdity of allowing a city to create essentially rubber stamp ordinances to completely circumvent the environmental review elements and requirements that triggered this review in the first place that are found in NEPA. Thank you, Your Honors. Unless there are any further questions, I rest my case.
We have no questions for you, counsel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel in this case. We very much appreciate hearing from you. This matter is now submitted to the Court of Appeals for a decision. We will issue a written decision within 90 days.